session number 19933, reel 1.
Dhanmada, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Karachi, now Pakistan. It was then British India.
Which year was this?
1920.
Can you tell me how you came to the background to how you came to be born in Karachi, please?
My parents ran a business there.
Oh, what kind of business?
At the time I was born, my father was assisting his father-in-law in a hotel, and then later on, my father acquired his own hotel business.
Did you stay long in Karachi?
Until the age of about 8 or 9, when I came to the UK, not for long, just for a few months.
But then, you didn't stay in England very long?
At that time, no. But then later on, in about 1933, 34, I came to school in England.
Where did you go to in between times?
A school in India.
Which school was that?
It was partly our local school in Karachi, known as the Grammar School, and then to a school in Simla.
What was life like for you as an English schoolboy in India in those days?
Very pleasant. A lot of the other pupils, of course, were Indian. Those who wanted an English education, there were Indian schools, of course. But those who wanted an education in English, and quite a lot of the well-to-do and not so well-to-do went to those schools.
So it was mixed English and Indian?
Oh, absolutely.
How did the boys get on with each other?
I didn't think of any differences.
What was the standard of education that you were getting at these two schools?
I think they were pretty good.
Did you specialise in something?
Not at that time, at the age of 13, 14, because then my parents thought it might be better if we came to a school in England, and that school was St Albans.
A grammar school?
I think it is now, what do they call them, direct grant school. At that time it was purely a public school.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
17.
So this is 37?
16, yes, must have been 1937, yes. And then I went to the University of London for 1 year.
To do what?
Civil engineering.
Why did you decide to go into that sphere?
I'd always been interested in something structural, construction, that sort of thing.
And is that what you were doing when war was declared?
When war was declared, I was on holiday in India. War was declared when, in August, September?
3rd of September.
3rd of September. I was due to come back to London University shortly after that. The term starts in October. But as soon as war started, there was a clampdown on all British people in India who can't leave the country. First I said, I've got to go back to continue my university course. Then I thought it might be better if I said, I've got to go back to join up. And I was told, now you sit tight here, you'll be called up here.
How long did you have to sit tight until?
Quite a long while. It was about 1947. The war had been going several months. In the meantime, I started working at a semi-civilian organisation under military control, but mainly staffed by civilians, Military Engineer Services, they called it. And then when I was called up, I went to an OCTU in India.
Where whereabouts was that?
That was in a little place called Roorkee, just near Dehradun, north of Delhi.
Had the war had any effect on India until then?
Only to the extent of certain everyday goods were rationed. Imports of luxury items, I suppose, weren't all that easy to get. But otherwise, India was not really affected, certainly not on the west side or the middle.
Had the Indian population reacted at all to the news of the outbreak of war?
No. Not at that time.
What happened to you at Octu?
Well, the Octu course was for 6 months. And as an officer cadet for those 6 months, you were the lowest of the low. And then I was commissioned into the same regiment that is that has its headquarters in Roorkee. That's the Bengal Sappers and Miners. King George V's own Bengal Sappers and Miners. It's a full title.
Did that suit you?
Yes, that did suit me. I mean, I didn't know where I was going.
Where did you find the unit?
This
unit, the Bengal Sappers and Miners.
Well, that the Bengal Sappers and Miners had its headquarters in Roorkee, which was where the particular Octu was. In fact, there were three. You probably know this better than I do. The three main sapper and miner units belonged to the old Bengal Army, the Bombay Army, and the Madras Army.
The three presidents.
That's why we were called Bengal Sappers and Miners, although none of our men were from Bengal, mainly Punjab.
What kind of a welcome, if any, did you get from the Bengal Sappers and Miners at Roorkee?
Excellent.
What date have we reached now, approximately?
1941. 42.
And then, what happened to you?
Well, I was with the Bengal Sappers and Miners. Well, I was with them all the time during my war service. In a training wing as a second lieutenant, looking after the Indian recruits. Most of whom were, they'd never seen mechanical transport or things like that, but mainly peasants.
Where mostly had they come from?
Mostly the Punjab, and some from further west, northwest frontier, the Pathans.
So were they mostly Muslims?
No, a lot of Sikhs from the Punjab. Sikhs, Muslims, and Hindus from the Punjab. And we had a few Hindus from what is now Uttar Pradesh. And the odd Gurkha, or people from the foothills of the Himalayas, Garhwalis.
How did the recruits get on with what you expected them to do?
I found them excellent, although they were mainly illiterate, very intelligent people, and very able.
What kind of instruction were you giving them?
Well, they were taught the basic drills. As a young officer, we were mainly guided by the what we call the Viceroy Commissioned Officers, similar to the Warrant Officer in the British Army. And they were really the power behind the throne. They used to guide me, tell me what I had to do. And the recruits were mainly taught ordinary parade ground drill, weapon training, and various engineering skills, bridge building, mines, mine clearance, explosives, the usual things that sappers and miners do. And in Ruriki we had a large canal, when I say large, maybe 200 or 300 foot wide. It was called the Ganges Jamuna Canal, going from the Ganges in the north to the river Jamuna further south. And that ran through Ruriki, and we used that for our water training.
Bridge building, you mean?
Bridge building, water training, bridge building also through dry gaps, but the types of bridges we often used were flying bridges.
What are they?
There's a steel wire rope stretched across the river, the waterway, and on that you have runners, sort of pulley on wheels, and the rope's going down to a raft or whatever, and the idea being in a flowing stream you turn your raft at 45 degrees to it, depending on which direction you want to go, and the water just took you right across on the wheels. They call those flying bridges.
Did it work all right?
Yes. And the faster the flow of the water, the faster you went across.
What were living conditions like at Ruriki in those days?
Well, as an officer, very good. Each had our own quarters. Very good officers' mess. And I found it okay.
What kind of people were your brother officers at that time?
Mainly white, European, and mostly British, a few Canadians, one or two South Africans, who didn't much like the idea at that time of seeing Indians carrying arms. And quite a few Indians also. I would say about 15-20% of our officers at that time were Indian. That's not talking about the Viceroy commissioned officers.
Any incidents that happened to you at this time?
Not really.
What happened in 42 when the so-called Quit India movement came on the scene?
At that time, I was on a short engineering course in Lahore at the McLagan Engineering College. The principal was given the rank of Lieutenant Colonel, and he had been involved in engineering before, because he always spoke about when he was involved with the Aswan Dam. But while I was there, all this business of Quit India and setting fire to post boxes and other things. So, and I occasionally went into the Indian bazaars. We seldom saw a white face. My main transport at that time was a bicycle. I went in there in uniform, and few people said to me, "Why don't we quit India? Why do we do?" But no physical violence or anything like that.
Were they unpleasant to you?
Not at all. Not at all. I never experienced any unpleasantness. They were trying to put their point of view forward. And at the same time, of course, we used to discuss these things with our Indian brother officers.
What was their point of view?
Their point of view was, "Well, look, we've got a war now. Let's get on with it. We'll talk about this afterwards." No, they said, "Well, obviously India wants its independence at some time, but this is not the time."
Did you ever feel uneasy at this time?
No. I never felt uneasy at all. In fact, I've been asked that before, when actually on active service in Burma. How did I feel with my Indian troops? Would they turn on me? The thought never occurred to me.
Ever feel uneasy amongst civilians, Indian civilians?
Not really, no. Travelling by train in India, of course, you come across civilians, you're in army uniform, they get talking to you, and obviously their independence was spoken about, but no unpleasantness, just a civilised conversation.
Did you ever come across Indians who said that the British should stay?
Yes, I did.
What type of Indians were they?
Mainly the, shall we call them, village peasants and the poorer types. The more educated ones, some of them also, but it was mainly the have-nots, shall we say, because they always regarded the British government as fair. And they wouldn't be better off under their own people. That was a feeling at the time.
So what happened to you next? You told me you were doing this course in Lahore.
Yes. Then after that, I went back to Roorkee. Back to the unit and to a training wing again. And during that time, I was also sent on a weapons training and battle school course somewhere in the central provinces. I suppose the largest town in the area was Jhansi. And I was sent there because my commanding officer, the colonel, told me I was putting on too much weight. It was an easy life at the regimental depot where you just had to supervise the training of the recruits. A very easy life. And then I what was I talking about now? Yes, I went on this battle school course. It was 6 weeks of weapon training first. Some of the instructors were British, some Indian. Just everyday weapons like mortars and machine guns, light machine guns, so on. Nothing of the heavy stuff, artillery and nothing like that. Just the lighter weapons. Then the battle school course, which was 1 month of misery. Hardly any rest in that time. You were on the go all the time. Heavy physical work. What do they call those things? Obstacle courses with full equipment and really, was really hard. But anyway, I left there very fit. But the result of it all was I hadn't lost weight. I'd lost inches, certainly, but I'd actually put on weight.
This is at Jhansi, did you say?
It was near Jhansi. The actual name of the place was Sagar. Sagar, I think they call it now. And the battle school itself was way out in the jungles.
How did you and your comrades view the prospect of meeting the Japanese if you thought you were going to meet them?
Well, we just thought we'd play it as it comes.
Was there any apprehension about it?
No.
What?
No, not that. I know earlier on, I think before General Slim took command of the 14th Army, the feeling was the Japanese were invincible and we couldn't do anything. And then I don't know whether it was subtle psychological propaganda or what, that we were all made to feel we were really far superior. And that was the general attitude.
Carry on.
The Japanese were a very determined enemy, and it was very rare to take prisoners at first.
What happened to you next after the battle school course?
I went back to my regimental depot in Roorkee, and then not long after that I was sent east through Calcutta, Bengal, to Burma. And the unit, the main unit I went to, of course, was the 15th Corps. Our corps commander at that time was Lieutenant General Christensen. And the function of that corps, of course, was to keep down in the Arakan area of southern Bengal, Burma, and go down the coast. Because inland from there, there were two or three mountain ranges, not really high mountains. I think I remember one, the Caladan Valley. And the situation was often we'd be advancing south down one valley, and the next valley, the other side of the mountain range, the Japanese be advancing north. There was never any sort of front line or things like that. But our function mainly was to go south. We went down to Chittagong, of course, that was in Bengal. Then further south, Bali Bazaar, Cox's Bazaar. I'm not sure if they were in Burma or in Bengal. And then down to the island of Ramri, just off the Burmese coast. And eventually, I mean, after, it's difficult to gauge how long we were there. Couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 weeks, because while we were there, one or two reconnaissance raids onto the mainland, where we had to depend on the Royal Navy. And I remember one particular occasion when they got their map reading wrong, and they were going to land us in a place different from what we had worked out that we wanted to do. So he pointed us out to the naval officer in command and various islands we saw and landmarks, because he had proper charts, we didn't. And he said, well, it must be wrong, and he agreed with us. But it was too late to do anything. The tide was going down, and we didn't want to be in a situation where at night we were vulnerable, the Japanese. So eventually we got back to our base on Ramri Island, but I don't know what really happened with the communications. It seems they were not expecting us, because when we landed there on our landing craft, we weren't a very big force. I doubt if we were as many as 100. They opened fire on us. They challenged us. Fortunately, it was a moonlight night, but we thought the best thing we could do was to just lie low, so we just lay on the wet beach until daylight, we could identify ourselves. There's only one occasion where we could have been hit by friendly fire.
And what was your job with 15 Corps at this time?
Well, at one time, I was with the Divisional CRE, Commander Royal Engineers, on his staff. He was usually a Lieutenant Colonel. And most of the time I was with an Indian field company, the 73rd Field Company.
Which division was this?
This was the 26th Indian Division.
How did you like doing these jobs?
It was great, a great variety of jobs.
And who was the CRE you were working for?
I remember him quite well. In fact, I can picture him. He was an Irishman, O'Connor.
What was he like to work for?
Lovely. I always remember him swearing. We We didn't have luxurious accommodation there, mostly on sandy beaches and so on, and lying on ground sheets. The colonel and all of us, we'd gouged out the sand, made it comfortable to fit the contours of our body. And the colonel's batman thought he was being good by straightening out the sand and sweeping it all nice and level for the colonel sahib. And every night the colonel sahib got back and they said, started swearing, why did he do that? He got it nicely shaped for his own body. But I really enjoyed that.
Which job did you prefer, the job with the CRE or the job with the field company?
Well, with the field company, you actually did things. With the CRE, you were on his staff, you were planning and liaising with the various field companies. With the field companies, you actually had command. As a lieutenant at that time, I had command of the platoon. And a platoon in a field company was something like 60 or 70 men. The lieutenant in command, and the Indian VCO was usually a jemadar, and then the usual havildars and naiks and all that.
So they were doing bridging work?
We did bridging work, partly mine clearance, demolitions, roads. Roads were a very important factor. We used, as far as we could, the beach along the west coast of Burma as a road. It was ready-made, washed by the tide every day, a nice hard surface, and the occasional watercourses, rivers that entered the sea there. We bridged them either with timber, teak forests just inland. And I remember one occasion trying to... I told my colonel, oh, we'll build a proper trestle bridge with teak. There's plenty of it in there. And he says, how are you going to get it here? I said, I'll float it down. He said, oh, yes. Anyway, we went with a party and chopped down timber. Thought we'd go in these small folding boats and drag it along with us. But the green teak was so heavy, it just sank. So we couldn't float it down. So what we did was... use rocky outcrops, just blasted them and got smaller pieces and built causeways with the rocks.
How did that work out?
It was rough, but it could get vehicles across. These little rivers, they call them chongs in Burma, they didn't really have high banks or anything, so the idea of putting a proper bridge or anything across wasn't really feasible. So we thought rock causeways, there's plenty of rock around, thought rock causeways would be the easiest thing to do.
Was the area formerly devoid of roads?
Yes, mainly. I mean, if you go inland... just a few jungle tracks here and there. We thought rather than cut roads through the jungle, this was an easier option. Particularly as time was always important.
So how would the Japanese manage for roads?
I don't think they bothered too much. I don't know how they did it. They had, in the centre of Burma, they did have their main road, but in this jungle area, possibly they constructed paths. They didn't, in our area, they didn't have an awful lot of motorised transport. Probably used mules. We didn't, we had some animal transport mules, but... not to any great extent. We also did have our vehicles, because there was a road built south from Chittagong, going right the way down